with Mike.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On January 1st, 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing slaves in all of the states engaged in rebellion against the Union. That edict also authorized the mobilization of African Americans to serve in the Union Army, inflating the ranks eventually by 180,000 people. For years, historians have argued about Lincoln's motivation for freeing the slaves. It marked a 180-degree turn in his thinking, even as it corrected one of the great evils of our nation. But it can also be argued that it simply helped the North to win the Civil War. In his new book, Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops, UNC Charlotte historian John David Smith tells both stories and joins us for the hour to explore them as well. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Dr. Smith will be speaking about his book at Personally Speaking at UNC Charlotte's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences next Tuesday evening at 6:30 here at UNC Charlotte Center City Campus, and there'll be a reception following the talk. Before we talk about Lincoln and how you got into Lincoln and how you've kind of changed your mind about Lincoln over the years, talk about the title of this book, Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops. Why that title?
Well, the whole question of the relationship between the U.S. Colored Troops and Lincoln is really instrumental in that without Lincoln, the U.S. Colored Troops, a federal element of the Union Army wouldn't have happened.
That's an official title.
Yes, that's the official title, U.S. Colored Troops. In 1863, in March, the Bureau of Colored Troops was established by the War Department. And what most people don't realize is that the vast majority of Union soldiers were state troops, the 53rd Ohio Volunteer Infantry. But in 1863, all black soldiers became federalized. So the first unit that was recruited in the U.S. Colored Troops was the first U.S. Colored Troops, and on and on and on. There were 133 infantry regiments alone, so the last one was the 133rd. So Lincoln's very short addition at the very end, almost like an afterthought in the final Emancipation Proclamation, declared that African Americans would and could serve in the federal forces. So he federalized African Americans, which is a very important, a revolutionary action on the part of the president.
Mm. You have written extensively not only about this period but about race and about African Americans in that period. You have 25 books. Where have you been? 25 books to your credit.
I've been busy.
Including The Dictionary of Afro-American Slavery, Slavery, Race, and American History, and Black Soldiers in Blue, African American Troops in the Civil War Era. What's your personal interest in this?
Well, I grew up in the civil rights movement in that era, growing up in the North. And also contemporaneously with that was the centennial of the American Civil War. So for me, the two things really intersected. Mm-hmm. And I've had a strong, obviously, interest in race and trying to understand what I call the power of race, of unequal power relationships defined by something as artificial as skin color, right, and ethnicity.
You have, this is the second book on the African-American people in the federal soldier in the blue uniform.
So, yeah.
Black Soldiers in Blue is the other one. What does this book do that the other book did not?
Sure. And actually, there's another one called Soldiering for Freedom that just came out. Okay. They're all different. The Black Soldiers in Blue is a collection of essays on the actual military actions of the U.S. Colored Troops. Soldiering for Freedom, as I said, it just came out. That deals with the whole process of how the U.S. Colored Troops came into being, mm-hmm, from the origins to their mustering out, as you will. This book focuses, the Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops, focuses on the, what I call the linear, the surprisingly linear process whereby Lincoln came, not quickly, but slowly, but faster than most historians argue, to the conclusion that African Americans, to keep the Union intact, to help suppress the rebellion, needed to be mobilized.
It's an evolution in his thinking, a metamorphosis, I suppose, that you could call it. But you've also gone through a metamorphosis of your own about Abraham Lincoln. You were not a fan. And that surprises me, given the fact that you just said a moment ago that you were very involved in the civil rights movement and wanted to understand race. And this man, and we'll talk about this later, was revered by the generation that lived in his lifetime and immediately thereafter. And for years after that, he was God. He was Moses. He was the deliverer. He was a very special person to African Americans. And you were not a fan. Why not?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. It's at least a two-part question you just asked. First thing is Lincoln was not revered by African Americans in the first 2 years of the Civil War.
No.
Lincoln was considered a very slow Frederick Douglass, lobbied and complained. And if you look at Frederick Douglass's newspaper, which he edited, he was very, very critical of Lincoln. And Lincoln reluctantly invited black clergymen to come and talk with him. And they constantly petitioned him to allow black soldiers to fight in 1861 and 62. In fact, numerous African Americans came to recruiting posts throughout the North, and they were turned away, that this was to be a white man's war. Remember, emancipation was certainly not one of the war aims. In 1861, in Lincoln's first inaugural in March, he made it very clear that this was not a war of abolition. This was a war to keep the Union together, to suppress what he later called a domestic rebellion. Now, as for me, I was growing up in the 1960s, and I was very much influenced by the critics of Lincoln, most notably Lerone Bennett, the Chicago editor of Ebony Magazine and the publisher. He wrote a very influential article, which I read when I was in college, called A Lincoln Honky. Underscoring, it's a great title. And he's recently written another book called Forced into Glory, which is very, very critical of Lincoln. It's critical of the Emancipation Proclamation for not freeing all the slaves, for dragging his feet, like what Lincoln said about George McClellan, that Lincoln suffered from a case of the slows. A case of the slows in terms of emancipation. That Lincoln's heart was not into emancipation. That he took steps to free some of the slaves slowly, to arm the free blacks and slaves slowly for purely pragmatic reasons. And there's a lot of truth in that. But in my own case, as I matured and as I've read and as I've thought long and hard about it, and worked very hard at not putting Lincoln into our day and trying to do what a historian is supposed to do, I've come to really appreciate the steps that Lincoln took.
One of the first, you told me before we started this conversation that one of your first jobs was going to work for a Lincoln library.
Yes, yes. My first job out of graduate school, it was very interesting. I was thrown into this Lincoln worship environment, which actually exacerbated my skepticism and cynicism of these Lincoln idolaters. They call them the Lincoln fraternity. Mm-hmm. The good part about all of that, I was surrounded by the largest collection of Lincoln material in the world and got to do some writing, do a lot of editing, and it broadened my horizons. But not until later did I really come to see the steps that Lincoln took. And it wasn't sheer pragmatism.
I would be accurate in saying that he was not at the start of the war and prior to his taking office, he was not an abolitionist.
That's a good question. Lincoln was never an abolitionist. What we would say about Lincoln, we would say he was an anti-slavery Republican, an anti-slavery Whig who became an anti-slavery Republican. By that, I mean that he believed in gradual emancipation. He believed in compensated emancipation. And here's the kicker. He believed in repatriation or colonization. As late as December 1862, Lincoln was encouraging African Americans to leave the United States.
Interesting you should bring that up, because Brian emails, why did Lincoln continue to push colonization up until, he says, 1864, you say 1862, just a year before his death, if he envisioned free blacks in a future America?
Well, it's not correct. Lincoln never made a public statement after late 1862. Now, he did, of course, in December 1862, got federal money to send a colony of Africans off the coast of Haiti. It failed. Lincoln always believed that the two races would have a very difficult time living in harmony. He felt that the historic, and he didn't use the word biological, but cultural differences and the anger and power of race, the negative qualities of slavery, and he abhorred slavery. He abhorred slavery, but he felt the races could not live in harmony. But ironically, the accomplishments of the U.S. colored troops, the heroic actions and patience and commitment to the Union cause and to their freedom, of course, converted Lincoln by the time of his death. Several days before he died, he was already starting to anticipate limited enfranchisement for black soldiers and degrees of citizenship.
So at the beginning of the war, and when he came to office, he said that the war was not about ending slavery. It was about the preservation of the Union. And did he say that? Of course, we can't really go into his mind. But did he say that because he believed it, or did he say it because it was a way to politically placate the South, particularly before the war broke out? Because the war didn't break out until after he'd taken office. Did he say it to placate the South in hopes that they would say, okay, well, he's not an abolitionist. He has no intention of taking our economic livelihood away from us. We'll be quiet.
I would argue that both were in play. Lincoln believed that, although he opposed slavery, Lincoln cherished the Declaration of Independence. Lincoln cherished ideals, but he was not an idealist. He realized, and he was a pragmatic person, he knew the Constitution very well, and he realized that the ideal of freedom was circumscribed by the Constitution, that the Constitution put severe restraints on freeing slaves. Lincoln was looking towards a modern America, a free labor America, and he saw slavery as an anachronistic labor system. Now, to your second point, Lincoln also was trying to placate the South. Remember, Lincoln's wife's family owned 50 slaves in Lexington, Kentucky. Right. He visited there many times. He had seen slavery. He understood not just the economic dimensions of slavery, but he understood the cultural and economic sides.
And abolitionists, who are most often associated with the North, were a small fraction of people in the North. There were people in the North who believed in slavery.
Oh, not only that, and as I tell my students, and it's very important to point this out, the degree of anti-black thought, white racism in the North and within the Union Army, particularly within the Union Army Officer Corps, was severe. And depending on where you want to go with this, there were anti-black riots, the July 1863 race riot. There were lynchings of blacks. The old northwestern states of Illinois, Ohio, they passed laws to prevent escaped slaves from the South during the Civil War to enter those states.
So the question is, how did he go from that point of view to the point of view that ended up freeing all these slaves and putting them in the army? And we'll get to that as we go through the hour with Dr. John David Smith, the Charles Stone Distinguished Professor of American History at UNC Charlotte and author of Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte. Presenting Harvey, the classic comedy follows Elwood P. Dowd and his best friend, a six-foot-tall invisible rabbit named Harvey. Now through February the 8th, tickets at carolinatix.org. Who would know more about living in poverty than someone who has lived in poverty? Donna Beagle is an expert because she was homeless for 28 years. She married at 15. She's the only person in her family to have gone to college. She is now an expert because of her PhD as well. She's made it her profession to get individuals out of poverty by educating other people about the barriers the poverty-stricken face. And she will join us to share some of what she knows tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, negotiators from 12 countries are hammering out details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What's inside the TPP, prospects for getting the trade deal through Congress, and what it could mean for the U.S. economy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is John David Smith, Dr. John David Smith at UNC Charlotte, written 25 books, the latest of which is Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops, which not only speaks about African-American participation in the Union armies leading up to the end of the American Civil War, but also the metamorphosis that Lincoln went through from the time he got into office to the time he was assassinated, that allowed for the emancipation of the slaves and their participation in the war. In the book you write, though most Northerners had enlisted in Abraham Lincoln's army to suppress the rebellion, they quickly came to grasp what the president had realized. The Union's restoration and slavery's destruction were inseparable. We can see that fairly clearly from the 21st century. Why did they not see it, and how did they come to see it?
Good question. Well, of course, slavery was a part of the warp and woof of American society. American capitalism thrived. New York merchants, shippers, the incipient textile industry in the Connecticut River Valley. Slavery was inseparable from the American experience, and that's hard for those of us today to think that such rigid racial hierarchies existed. But one needs to think in terms of the middle of the 19th century, mm-hmm. when racial hierarchies were normal, when beliefs in racial differences were frightfully real and understood and accepted. The nation had existed for decades with slaveholding presidents. The first, five or six presidents all owned slaves or had some connection.
Slaves built the White House and the Capitol building.
And not only that, but if universities, colleges were named, Yale's colleges are named for one's named for John C. Calhoun. Slavery was part of the texture of every corner, and its tentacles touched every element of American life. So Lincoln comes into this situation where he has first seven, then 11 states, and four so-called loyal slave states that are teetering on secession, and South Carolina and the other southern states secede.
I know this is not in your book, but since you're a Lincoln expert and you're an expert on the period, what was it about Abraham Lincoln's election that so, I guess, infuriated and scared South Carolinians first, because they were the first to secede, and all of the other states who joined them eventually in secession? What was it about him? And when he clearly said, I'm not going to free your slaves, I am not an abolitionist, status quo.
Right. Well, first place, these states had been talking about secession. Thomas Jefferson referred to a fire bell in the night during the Missouri Compromise conflict in 1819 to 1821. This was not a new concept of secession, and there was a convention after the Compromise of 1850 called the Nashville Convention of Southern States talking in 1850 about leaving the Union.
Because of the threat of the end
of slavery?
Because of
the threat of federal. If you'll think about the Compromise of 1850 and the challenges to the expansion of slavery, the reason Southern states were so upset about Lincoln was starting in 1856, when John C. Fremont was the Republicans' first standard bearer. Their first presidential campaign was in 1856, and Lincoln campaigned for John C. Fremont. Their first plank in their platform was to limit the extension of slavery.
But wouldn't that have improved Southern prospects if slavery was only going to be allowed in the states in which it existed, in the South, and it was not going to be allowed into the expanding territories and states that would come out of it? Wouldn't that have put the South in a better economic position?
No, because the problem with slavery and Southern agriculture was Southern Southerners were not conservative in their land use. They constantly, if you look at South Carolina, for example, South Carolina's economic history moved very, very quickly from the coast to the Piedmont, and then they ran out of space. Slavery and its expansion was already into East Texas, and Southerners were constantly talking about needing more land, needing more land. In fact, during the debates over what became the Compromise of 1850, Senator Jefferson Davis, soon to be Secretary of War under Franklin Pierce, he came up with an idea of drawing a line across the United States from east to west, and slavery would exist below so that they could have slavery in California, that they could have slavery in New Mexico. They believed that slavery would work even in these arid areas. So Southern whites had an insatiable demand for more territory, for more slaves, and more slave-produced crops.
Because they would – I don't understand. That mm-hmm. Because they would – expand their own plantations to take advantage of
extra land? Well, it wasn't just plantations. They needed more land. Southern whites.
So they would want to buy more land so they could operate more land?
Most of that was federal territory, land west of the Mississippi River.
Okay.
The Missouri Compromise of 1820-21 drew a line north of the degrees on the latitudinal lines on the map of 54 degrees 40 minutes, 54-40. And it stopped at the eastern terminus of the Rocky Mountain line. So this was contested from 1821 up until 1854. And after 1854, the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which led to the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, that threw open the possibility of settlement north of 54-40. So back to your original question, Southerners were cheered at the Kansas-Nebraska Act because it opened land that heretofore had been closed to the slavery's expansion. And the Republican Party, and Lincoln, of course, was their standard bearer in 1860, said, no, if we're elected, we're going to do everything we can not to put away slavery where it exists, but to prevent it from expanding.
Okay. Were they right? Were Southerners right? Were they in assuming that if they didn't get more territory, their way of life was doomed?
They believed that.
Okay.
They believed that. They understood that there were serious restraints to the expansion, and they defined it as their way of life. You know, when people talk about some Southerners, to this day talk about the Southern way of life. Well, that was totally entwined with slavery and an agrarian society and small government, and it goes all back to what caused the Civil War, which, of course, is a very complicated subject and a volatile subject, particularly in the South. But that Southern way of life was a phrase that encompassed all kinds of things.
What led Lincoln to the Emancipation Proclamation? Because, as you say, he was not an abolitionist.
No, he was not.
And he was thinking about colonization just 2 years before the Emancipation. And historically, societies that had slavery got rid of it very slowly over time. He was going to do it like that.
Well, that's not – Your first point's right, and I'm really glad you said that. In a comparative way, whether we're talking about Russian serfdom or the British and the French in the Caribbean, it was called gradual emancipation and compensated emancipation. Well, Lincoln tried that. But let's go back a little bit earlier. Lincoln wanted to suppress the rebellion with slavery intact, and that's what he said in his first inaugural. He said, you can't leave – I'm not going to – the South, you can't leave the Union. You know, we've already done that. We have a U.S. Constitution. The Articles of Confederation was a failure. Now we have a federal republic, and you don't have to worry about slavery, but you're going to have to worry if you fire on federal forts, if you take federal property, if you commit, quote, treason. So as long as nothing too serious happens, everything's going to be all right. Well, things became very serious, and for the first year and a half of the Civil War, Lincoln couldn't do what he said he was going to do. He was not successful at suppressing the rebellion militarily. He called up 75,000 volunteer troops after Fort Sumter in April of 1861, and he and his military proved incompetent. So Lincoln had to find a way. So gradually, and here's what most historians don't get. gradually Lincoln's supported steps, and this is why I say it's much more linear than most historians see, this process of what I call military emancipation. Starting in August of 1861 and ending in July of 1862, Lincoln supported in a very low-key way four key pieces of legislation: two confiscation acts, an additional article of war, and a militia act. Now, these have been obscured. Historians don't usually talk about them, and they're very complicated. But basically what they did was step by step making it hard for Confederates or pro-Southern sympathizers to reclaim their escaped slaves. Because the minute federal troops entered the Confederacy, surprise, surprise, African Americans came to their lines. This happened as early as May of 1861.
And you write about something that I did not know about, and that is that when they came to those lines, they didn't know what to do with them.
Exactly.
They put them in camps.
They didn't know what to do with them. At first, Lincoln's government said, send them back. Mm-hmm. To be consistent with what he said in his inaugural. Mm-hmm. But Benjamin Butler, who was quite a character, he was a Massachusetts politician, one of those political generals. He was in charge of Fortress Monroe, a camp. And May of 1861, African American slaves came to his lines, and he said, we're not going to give them back. You're now contraband of war. Well, soon after, in August, the federal government started this process of gradually but successfully tightening the screws, making it harder to return these escaped slaves.
Plus, they began to see these slaves as assets. They were people who allowed the South to be as successful as they had been.
Right. Lincoln later is going to call this, you know, Lincoln was quite a phrase maker. He was a brilliant thinker in terms of the way he could condense words. He called it a double gain. For every slave who came to Union lines and then who became a soldier, that was a gain for the Union Army. And of course, the Union Army needed men, mm-hmm. needed fighters. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it denied the Confederates workers, right. laborers. So it was a double gain.
The Emancipation Proclamation not only freed slaves on a certain date in territory still in rebellion, as you say.
That's the second emancipation. Remember, there are two.
Okay.
There's the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. This is very interesting. It's in September, right after Antietam or Sharpsburg, the closest thing McClellan had to a victory. If I can back up a second,
sure.
One of the reasons Lincoln started, and Lincoln, you know, it was a six-month process. From the summer of 1862 until January – from June, essentially, until January 1st of 1863, Lincoln was moving on emancipation. But it was after the disastrous Peninsula Campaign under McClellan in the summer – spring and summer of 1862 that Lincoln decided he had to take revolutionary steps. And he started conceptualizing the Emancipation Proclamation, which he issued in two parts. The first part was the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, issued on September 22nd, 1862, after the closest thing that they had to a victory. It was a stalemate at the Battle of Antietam in Maryland. And this argued that if the Confederates did not stop their rebellion by January 1st, 1863, that slaves in territory then in rebellion would be free. And Lincoln also included in that preliminary document a colonization statement. Mm. A colonization statement. So he's saying this in September 1862. No mention of arming blacks. That said, in one of those bills that I was talking about, it's the Militia Act of July 17th, 1862, Lincoln had already gained from Congress permission to use African Americans in any military way he wished. But the intent of that act of July 17th, 1862, was to use blacks as military laborers. Now, back to your point. The January 1st Emancipation Proclamation that we all think of, January 1st, 1863, the colonization was gone, and it was clear that Lincoln was going to use his war powers as commander-in-chief to mobilize blacks as armed soldiers.
So how did he get from one point to the other? Was it because he needed the soldiers, he needed the men, he needed those African-Americans in the army to fight? Was he punishing the South? How much of it had to do with the fact that there were European countries who were about to align themselves with the South? They didn't like slavery, so if he abolished slavery, they might come to the Union side, and did.
All of the above.
Okay.
All of the above. It's very complicated. Lincoln realized that he needed to take a radical, revolutionary move. And what could be more radical and revolutionary than to strike at the core of the South's economic, social system? It also was a clear statement to England that this was going, because, you know, what you say about aligning themselves with the Confederacy, the English, of course, they were on the lead. The French and the other countries were going to do whatever England did. England loved the American Civil War, loved keeping the United States divided. You notice the French sent a delegate and a puppet into Mexico. So as if Lincoln didn't have enough problems, there was a French presence in Mexico on the southern border of the United States. Lincoln realized that this was a radical step he needed, and he also was hopeful that he would have black soldiers. Now, he had no idea how well these black soldiers would work, and if we want to talk later about what the black soldiers actually did and all of that. So it's all of these things. Lincoln wanted to strike what he called in one of his speeches the emancipation lever. It was the emancipation lever to strike a blow. He needed to do this to win the war. So that's that pragmatic side of Lincoln.
What was the Southern reaction? Because obviously in territories where we were losing the war.
Yeah.
Well, the North was losing
yes.
the war. In territories where they had no Union troops, it was like a paper tiger. Right?
Exactly. I
mean, nothing.
And that's exactly what Jefferson Davis's government said. They said something like this rhetorically. See those black Republicans. They said they weren't going to take our slaves, but look what they're doing. That Lincoln, he's a liar. He's doing exactly what we said all along, and we must fight harder. Our independence must be attained to prevent the black Republicans from destroying our civilization.
Well, there was certainly that risk, because that was motivation to fight harder.
Fight harder,
and
yeah.
You write about in the book when the African-American soldiers came over to the Union side, when the African-Americans came over to the Union side, became soldiers, they had a reason to fight hard because...
Because Jefferson Davis had his Congress pass a law that said that any African-American soldier would be returned to their private to their owner, and free blacks from the North would be enslaved, and their white officers would be executed.
Wow. John David Smith is our guest. Dr. John David Smith, author of Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops. He is also a professor of history at UNC Charlotte. We're going to come back and talk about what exactly these African-American people did in the Union armies, how successful they were, and the contributions they made when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at The Secret Chocolatier, creating handmade chocolate roses, cakes, and confections, accepting orders for Valentine's Day, shipping provided, store locations near Cotswold and Ballantyne, online orders at thesecretchocolatier.com. Negotiators from 12 countries are hammering out the tales of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a look at what's inside the TPP, prospects for getting the deal through Congress, and what it could mean for the U.S. economy. Just some of the things they'll be talking about in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation with Dr. John David Smith about Lincoln and the colored troops, well, now's the time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
You can hear Morning Edition from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Don David Smith, the Charles Stone Distinguished Professor of American History at UNC Charlotte, is our guest, talking about his latest book, Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops. By the way, he'll be speaking about it at UNC Charlotte Center City next Tuesday at 6:30, and the public's invited to that. You write that by the war's end, the Union Army had raised 178,975 enlisted men for the U.S. colored troops. These are slaves who, as the Union troops incurred into the South, came over to the side of the Union and enlisted in the Union Army. 19% of these troops came from the North, 14 from the Union slave states, and 57% came from the 11 Confederate states. How did they know? First of all, how did they know about the emancipation? How did they know that they could enlist? And what would make them want to enlist?
Good question. African Americans knew what was going on. There are different theories about what exactly was going
on. Because they couldn't read, most of them.
Well, they couldn't read, but they certainly had a network, you know, the old grapevine network. And I believe in that. I've read enough accounts in the slave narrative collection of elderly slaves during the New Deal era who recalled what they had heard. And there are accounts, autobiographies of African Americans after the Civil War. They knew what this war was about. They could tell from the whites' reactions. So they knew what was going on. Secondly, the Union Army was very aggressive. As the Union armies enveloped the Confederacy, recruiters came down in a couple different approaches, but basically down the Mississippi River line, and either voluntarily accepted African Americans or dragooned them into Union military service. And in fact, in the book, I mention how Lincoln sent telegrams to certain officers to say, stop forcing African Americans into service. What the recruiters would do, would come in with black soldiers with dress uniforms on and epaulettes and gold buttons and say, look what you can wear, and you're going to get free meals and all of this. And that didn't always work because African Americans weren't necessarily quick to enlist. But having said that, African American families flooded to the Union lines. In fact, William Tecumseh Sherman tried to reject black families from coming because he was a military man and he felt these people were encumbering his army. So that was not a problem finding recruits. And as you say, 57% of the men of the U.S. colored troops came from the slave states. So this was an opportunity for freedom. Hopefully they could bring their families. And late in the war, Congress passed a law in freeing the families of the soldiers as well.
The 14% of the members of the colored troops who came from the Union slave states.
Yeah, the loyal slave states.
Were they allowed to leave their masters, so to speak?
That's a great question. I particularly know the story of Kentucky well. And Lincoln worried about Kentucky. It was his state. He was born. He once said, you know, to lose Kentucky is the same as to lose the entire game. Mm. He was very concerned about Kentucky, and he was constantly talking about Kentucky. And Kentucky had the second largest number of black soldiers after Louisiana. Louisiana had something like 22,000 slaves who joined the Union Army. Kentucky had 21,000. So it was a rampant situation for Kentucky slaveholders, which was a loyal slave state. And there was all kinds of tension. Loyal masters said, look, we're loyal. You can't have it both ways, Lincoln. We're loyal. These are our slaves. They're protected by the Constitution, but the slaves went. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes very heavy-handed Union commanders went to Kentucky farms and plantations and dragooned the blacks.
America's racists were not particular to the South. There were racists all over the country. And as you said earlier in this conversation, our consideration of race, it was so much a part of who we were as a people and what we thought. We didn't think about it. It was what it was.
It was a given.
That's right. It was a given. So it must have been very difficult for a lot of people to adjust to this, not only having African Americans fighting, but arming these people.
Yeah, and when Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation I've studied this very closely. There were quite a few, many Union officers who tendered their resignation. Mm. They said, we didn't sign on for this. We want no part of this. And there were Union generals who refused to command black troops, and Lincoln, in some cases, just fired them. My colleague at Georgetown University, Chandra Manning, has written a very interesting book in which she shows how Union soldiers gradually came around. And much like the movie, the 1989 movie, which many of your listeners have seen, Glory,
right,
which has some flaws in it. But I think one of the things that is successful, I think it's Hollywood after all, but that indeed whites came around. And how do whites come around? They saw that blacks were competent, that black soldiers were committed. They could do more than just serve as fatigue laborers, and that they could fight. And Lincoln saw this too.
I want to talk about what they experienced and what kinds of battles they fought in and how they were treated in the military. But let's go back and talk about Frederick Douglass
for a sec.
Frederick Douglass, how would he compare to his relationship and what he told Lincoln behind the scenes and how he kind of nudged and pushed and cajoled? How does that compare to what Dr. Martin Luther King did with Lyndon Johnson?
Very good question. Frederick Douglass pushed very, very hard and was rebuffed. He was rebuffed for the first 2 years of the war. After 1863, he all of a sudden was gained entree to the White House. In fact, there's a wonderful story about there was a reception in 1864, and Lincoln had invited Douglass. And Douglass comes, and the guard said, you can't come in. And then Douglass made it. He didn't mess with Douglass. He was quite a formidable character, literally and figuratively. And he said, yes, I'm coming in. And Lincoln heard about this, and he said, ah, there's my friend Frederick Douglass. By all means, let him in. And that was an incredible moment. I think there are parallels between Martin Luther King. I think there.
Did King take a page from Douglass's book, perhaps?
I think he. Of course, he used. I think much probably more gentle language. Mm-hmm. I think he was probably more savvy politically, but I think his presence and I think his impact on LBJ certainly accomplished the same sort of goal.
Did Douglass play a role in encouraging African-Americans to sign
Well, two of his sons, as you know,
right,
served in the U.S. Colored Troops in the 54th and 55th Massachusetts Regiment. And interestingly enough, Lincoln sort of promised – notice I say sort of. It was a little squishy. It's in the book. Promised Douglass a commission in the U.S. Colored Troops as an officer. And there were only about 100 black commissioned officers. And that's a very politically charged question. Because remember, being an officer was an elite thing. I might add that being a soldier in the U.S. Army was a mark of citizenship. And remember how white Southerners viewed the idea of African Americans with guns. It was very fearful, very scary. But anyway, Douglass never got his commission.
Lincoln, I'm told, I learned from your book, told Frederick Douglass after the troops had fought for a while and displayed remarkable heroism.
Yes.
That their heroism in battle constituted necessary preparatory work for Lincoln to make the case for limited black suffrage for black males. As you said, being in the Army was a mark of citizenship.
Citizenship,
suddenly,
right.
Suddenly these African Americans were citizens. Now he's talking about giving them the right to vote.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was very, very careful in saying this. He actually had this correspondence with one of his Union governors. You know, as the Confederacy was falling, Lincoln tried to establish loyal governments in Louisiana. He tried in Florida. Mm-hmm. He tried in Arkansas. And this, of course, was all playing out right as the war was ending. And he was trying to organize loyal governments in these states. And in one case with Louisiana, he said, well, when they're writing a provisional constitution, let's consider giving limited suffrage to educated African Americans. In Lincoln's last public speech, which he gave from the White House several days before John Wilkes Booth murdered him, Lincoln talked about enfranchising educated black men and those who have served as our soldiers. And then he was assassinated. So clearly, as Lincoln was planning, he called it restoration.
Right.
We call it reconstruction. Lincoln realized that there was no turning back. The Emancipation Proclamation, and of course, as you know from seeing the Lincoln movie, which is quite accurate except for the opening scene with black soldiers, which is totally inaccurate.
Right. And that's where they come up to him and thank him.
Oh, and start repeating the Gettysburg Address, which is completely, completely ridiculous. Because you can rest assured, I would have found someone who had actually talked to Lincoln in my research. I would have found that, and there's no such evidence.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is Lincoln was so concerned, and this is important, Lincoln was so concerned that Congress would overturn emancipation that he pushed and pushed to get the 13th Amendment through Congress, which of course was not ratified until long after Lincoln was in his grave.
Looking back from the 21st century, the way these African-American men were treated when they joined the Union Army, how they were used, it's appalling. Was it regarded that way in its time, even by the troops?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was all manner, and I spend a lot of time in my book, as you know, talking about this, the levels of discrimination against African Americans, everything from pay to their uniforms, to their equipment, to their medical care, to the food that they were given, and to the assignments they were given. Because of that Militia Act of July 1862, most congressmen saw these blacks as laborers. So they, much as African Americans in World War I and early in World War II were designed to do fatigue work, emptying wagons, backwater troops.
They were considered labor. Better
were
suited
considered
to be laborers.
But that said, of course, as you know, the blacks fought in 449 separate engagements and in some larger battles and proved their mettle in combat.
Mm-hmm.
But without question, there was all kinds of discrimination, and Lincoln was aware of it. Lincoln tried to overcome the wage discrepancy, and there's actually a good scene in the movie Glory on this where the soldiers wouldn't accept their unequal pay.
And they fought for a year without accepting
yes,
pay.
Yes, yes. And that, not just the 54th, but other right. units too. And there were cases of treason, of uprisings by soldiers who were hanged because they rose up against their leaders because they said, here we're fighting and we're not being treated equally. Lincoln was aware of this. And, you know, getting back to your question about racism, remember there were very many conservative senators and congressmen in Washington who felt that Lincoln was going way too fast on all this.
To quote from your book, these black soldiers endured reduced pay, inferior medical care, inadequate weapons, inappropriate rations, insufficient training, the prospect of being enslaved, as you mentioned, or executed if captured by the Confederates, insults from white troops, brutal punishments for things that
yes.
they did or didn't do.
Much like as they were treated as slaves.
As slaves.
Yeah.
More than 68,000 black soldiers died during their service.
Yeah.
But only 2,751 died from activities that happened in combat. The rest died.
Yeah, one in five died from disease.
Yeah. How does that compare with white soldiers in the Union Army or even Confederate soldiers in their armies? Because medical care was...
Yeah, one out of every 12 whites died of disease. So, first place, it was very difficult to get regimental surgeons for white units. It was almost impossible to find regimental surgeons for blacks. In fact, I wrote another book called Black Judas about an African-American soldier. And the man that took his arm off, he was an amputee, was a licensed midwife from England who came over to the United States and got his medical degree. So he wasn't particularly well trained. So again, African Americans suffered. They had the worst of every possible situation, and they tended to be posted in backwater assignments, the area where dismal swamp kind of conditions, malarial environments, which the racial pseudoscience of the day believed that blacks could thrive in these kinds of areas and whites could not.
Mm-hmm.
So blacks were put in the worst areas with bad water, bad hygiene, and they weren't well maintained.
You close your book with a really interesting anecdote about the fact that after Lincoln is assassinated, and 3 days later they're taking his casket on a caisson from the White House to the Capitol building to lay in state. It's a two-hour trip. I don't know how many blocks it is, but it's not many. But a unit of African-American soldiers, the 22nd Unit, came up from wherever they were fighting to be part of it.
Right.
And they found themselves purely by accident
at
the head of the procession.
Exactly. And then they did like in perfect sync, in perfect harmony, you know, parade left, cut right in front of the white troops and led the procession. And then after that, as I say in the book, a day or so later, they went off looking for John Wilkes Booth. They were part of the contingent of troops.
It's poetic justice, suppose. John David Smith's book is called Lincoln and the U.S. Colored Troops. It really is fascinating, and it brings up a lot of things that, and I consider myself kind of a minor Lincoln buff, brings up a lot of things that I didn't know. So it makes for interesting reading. Thank you very much for the hour. Come back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Charlotte Talk.